The headlines this hour: Iran says Washington's noncompliance with its obligations is the main threat to any agreement in the Vienna talks. Another day of Israeli atrocities in the occupied West Bank. Regime forces make multiple arrests amid mounting tensions in a Palestinian neighborhood. And Canada's Prime Minister declaring a state of emergency to end the trucker-led protest that started in Ottawa but spread to blockade border crossings with the U.S. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's top security official calls the proven U.S. noncompliance the most significant threat to any agreement as talks on the revival of the 2015 Iran deal are underway in Austria's capital. Ali Shamkhani says verification and guarantees, the two main demands set up by Iran, are the integral part of a good agreement. In a tweet posted hours ago, he noted that the real removal of sanctions means that Iran would enjoy reliable and sustainable economic benefits. Back in 2018, the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the Iran deal and brought back the sanctions. Now Iran and the remaining signatories are engaged in intensive negotiations to restore their agreements. Earlier, Iran's foreign minister spoke with his British counterpart on the phone and urged all parties to show seriousness in the ongoing talks. Hossein Amir Abdollahian added that the recent progress made is due to the logical approach that Tehran has adopted. Meanwhile, China, also a party to the deal, has called the U.S. the culprit in the ongoing standoff and urged Washington to take active measures to resolve the remaining issues in the earliest possible time. Iran's deputy ambassador to the United Nations says unilateral sanctions against her country amount to crimes against humanity. Zahra Ershadi denounced the sanctions on medication and humanitarian goods. She said a lot of Iranian children have lost their lives due to drug shortages caused by such inhumane bans. The Iranian envoy stressed that countries which impose sanctions on other nations should not go unpunished. Ershadi emphasized that her country demands an immediate halt to all coercive measures, including imposing sanctions. She said a removal of sanctions on Iran can provide the country with guarantees for achieving economic and social development. The U.S. has imposed illegal sanctions against Iran with the aim of crippling its economy. It further stepped up the bans after unilaterally withdrawing from the 2015 deal. We spoke to University Professor Fuad Azadi to get his thoughts on the unilateral sanctions against Iran. He believes that international human rights organizations need to step in and to show their opposition to this illegal act.
Iran is used to this type of illegal behavior, and it's time for international human rights organizations to seriously oppose this criminal behavior that the U.S. has been engaging for many, many years.
The Israeli regime is pushing ahead with the demolition of Palestinian homes, this time in Masafer Yatta, an area south of the occupied West Bank. The area is located south of Al-Khalil and has seen a series of buildings knocked down in recent months. It's not known what exactly is causing the sudden increase in demolitions there. But the Israeli military frequently pulls down Palestinian structures in the occupied West Bank with the excuse that they lack construction permits. Whereas the targeted buildings are often set up on grounds that have been owned by Palestinians for generations. Palestinians say that the demolitions are part of the regime's expansionist policy and ethnic cleansing agenda. Bahraini political activists in Iran have held a presser to highlight atrocities of the Bahraini royal family against its people. The press conference comes on the anniversary of Bahrain's 2011 uprising against the ruling Al-Khalifa dynasty. Yusuf Jalali has more.
As Bahrainis are marking the 11th anniversary of the February 14th uprising against the ruling Al-Khalifa regime, Bahraini rights activists in Iran are calling on their people to stay steadfast in their struggle against the regime's unjust policies.
We will never give up, and we will continue our fight for freedom and for the constitution that our nation can write that with his hand, with his people who are free, and they would like to be free forever.
Since February 2011, Bahrain has been the scene of pro-democracy protests by Bahrainis who complain about discrimination in the Persian Gulf Kingdom. The Bahraini regime has since clamping down on sign of dissent and has imprisoned and executed a large number of protesters. In a televised speech aired from Iran's city of Qom, Bahrain's pro-Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Qassem, called for the establishment of a democratic and constitutional system to replace the Al-Khalifa dynasty.
There is no solution to the ongoing political crisis in Bahrain in the absence of a democratic constitution. The ruling Al-Khalifa regime's insistence on the policy of injustice will only open up rifts and create deep social divisions. Bahrain must be set free from the shackles of oppression.
Activists here also slammed Al-Khalifa for normalizing its ties with Israel, saying the move shows that the regime has no respect for the ideology of its people. The Bahraini rights activists say Al-Khalifa and Al-Saud are the puppets of Israel and the U.S., serving their interests in the region.
Bahrain is entering a critical stage and is turning into another Palestine. Israel is increasing its influence on the subordinate Al-Khalifa regime and is seeking to build military bases in Bahrain. This is a serious threat to the entire region, including Iran.
The Bahraini activists argue that without Israeli and American support, the autocratic regimes in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia would collapse in a few days.
Political activists here say Al-Khalifa's brutal crackdown on dissent is proof of their illegitimacy to rule the country. They say the revolution will not subside until the Bahraini royal family relinquish power, on the grounds that it does not represent the majority of Bahrainis. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Canadian Prime Minister invokes rarely used emergency powers to end prolonged protests against COVID restrictions that have shut down some border crossings and paralyzed parts of the capital.
The federal government has invoked the Emergency Act to supplement provincial and territorial capacity to address the blockades and occupations. I want to be very clear. The scope of these measures will be time-limited, geographically targeted, as well as reasonable and proportionate.
Justin Trudeau says that he cannot allow the blockades to continue as they are harming Canada's economy and endangering public safety. The powers allow the federal government to override the provinces and authorize special measures to protect security during national emergencies. This comes amid growing frustration over what critics see as a permissive approach by police to demonstrations in some areas. The protest started by Canadian truckers opposing obligatory vaccination for cross-border travels. The movement has turned into a rallying point for people opposing various policies of Trudeau's government. The Canadian Parliament has 7 days to decide whether to approve the use of the emergency measures. 4 provinces have already opposed the plan, saying that it is unnecessary. The European Union says it is ready to discuss Russia's security concerns just as an extraordinary flurry of diplomacy is underway over the Ukraine crisis. EU's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, says the only way to fulfill everybody's concerns is through dialogue. Meanwhile, Russia has transferred some of its troops deployed near Ukraine back to their military bases. Also, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said earlier that there is still a chance of striking an agreement on security with the West. Moscow is seeking security guarantees against NATO's eastward enlargement, including a permanent ban on Ukraine's accession. Russia also denies Western accusations of planning an invasion into its neighbor. The U.S. and NATO, however, are refusing to concede, saying it's up to the member states to decide on security alliances of their choosing. Human rights groups are accusing Myanmar's military of committing a series of atrocities in the eastern state of Karenni that may constitute war crimes. Fortify Rights says troops have massacred civilians and have used them as human shields while attacking churches, homes and camps for displaced people in the Flashpoint state. The group says its evidence shows at least 60 civilians have been killed in Karenni since May, when the military began a crackdown on local ethnic militias. The fighting has forced nearly 180,000 people, more than half of the state's population, to flee to safety. 2 other groups also say soldiers burnt some 40 villagers alive in their vehicles on Christmas Eve. They are now calling on regional nations to impose an arms embargo on Mars Junta over the crimes. The army seized power last February following a coup d'etat. Campaigning formally begins in South Korea for a presidential election dominated by political scandals. 14 candidates are running for president in the vote, planned for the 9th of March. It is expected to be the tightest race in 2 decades between the ruling Democratic Party and the main opposition People Power Party. Polls show that they are neck and neck, but their prospects are being undermined by repeated scandals, including the abuse of power by incumbent and former officials. Polls show that fighting corruption is a top priority for Korean voters when choosing the next person who will rule their country. Anger over a ban on hijab in Indian schools is gaining momentum. As Munawar Zaman reports from New Delhi, it has galvanized the public sentiments, with people of all faiths questioning the religious freedom and equality in the world's most diversified, plural, and largest democracy.
Sadhika, a 12th grade student in New Delhi, is outraged. She says it could perhaps be the first time in Indian history a particular community is being targeted for what they wear. Earlier, it would be our mosques, what we eat, our marriages, our personal laws. Now it's what we wear.
Being an Indian, we are very proud to be here, and we feel like every human being has a right to decide. They have their own choice. We don't need to interfere between their choices. The constitution also gives us right like that.
Last week, a video circulating on social media became a sensation within a few hours. A young college student from the southern Indian state of Karnataka was heckled by a group of saffron-clad Hindu students chanting slogans hailing Hindu deity Rama. The girl responded back with a similar reaction, chanting Allahu Akbar, which means God is great. The incident blazed the public sentiments, with many calling the girl lioness, while others hailed her an Iron Lady. As India's state elections are underway, experts say polarizing the voters is a common phenomenon in India, with religion being the easy tool.
All effort is to try to erase Muslims from public places and to prevent them from being seen in public and impose apartheid on Muslim women. They are trying to achieve that target, but it's not as easy as they are thinking.
Another college student who spoke on the condition of anonymity said the ruling BJP might rewrite the constitution, considering their policies and actions they are imposing in a country.
It's the personal choice of a person to wear whatever they want to do, and according to constitution, we have the rights. It's totally a sad thing, and it's really like particularly targeting a particular community, due to which we start living in a threat.
Ban on Islamic handscarves has outraged the Muslim community, saying it's an outright attack on their faith, which the constitution guarantees to safeguard. They say it could perhaps be an attempt to prevent Muslim women from attaining education or to flare communal tensions amid elections. Observers say anti-Muslim rhetoric has flared aggressively since BJP formed the government in 2014. They say since 2014, most of the elections in India were overly polarized. Religious divide has been the main trump card of the current administration. Based on rights groups, the ruling BJP has adopted various laws and policies that legitimize violence and targeting religious minorities. Experts say it's a larger political agenda to make India a supremacist Hindu nation. Meanwhile, protesting student groups have defended the use of hijab, saying the constitution guarantees them religious freedom. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Liz Truss is Britain's highest-ranking diplomat at the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA, as well as the minister representing the UK in the tense standoff between the West and Russia. She's also one of the politicians with her eye on Britain's greatest political prize, replacing Boris Johnson as the country's prime minister. Amina Taylor takes a closer look at the woman some are dubbing the new Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Liz Truss has gone from political also-ran to holding one of the highest offices of state in the UK, the country's representative to the globe. Promoted by Boris Johnson from International Trade Secretary to Foreign Secretary, with the additional job of solving the Brexit standoff with the EU, as well as pushing through with the talks in Vienna on the revival of the JCPOA. Truss has only been an MP since 2010. Whilst her in-tray may be overflowing, reports reveal the behind-the-scenes briefing Truss has had, this to gauge support as she fights a silent battle with Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. He's seen by many as her main rival for the Prime Minister's position should Johnson quit or be ousted. Truss's shift from staunch Remainer to ardent Brexiteer via a Margaret Thatcher-style makeover has not convinced everyone of her Iron Lady credentials.
I think Liz Truss is regarded by a lot of backbenchers as being quite lightweight. I think there's possibly a bit of sexism in that, but although the Conservative Party has had two women leaders, unlike Labour, I think we've also seen Liz Truss last week in Moscow really banging the war drums, trying to show how tough she was in regards to the whole Ukraine-Russia question. And I think part of that was to please Tory backbenchers.
It's a short walk from the Foreign Office to Downing Street, a fact that would not be lost on Liz Truss and her advisers. It's also a short political step from one of the senior offices of state to the top job. Just ask Boris Johnson, who was Foreign Secretary before replacing Theresa May as Prime Minister. For a politician with such an important diplomatic brief, scandal has followed Truss with question marks about her judgment. Highlights or lowlifes include racking up thousands on expenses whilst on a three-day trip to Japan, claims of cronyism and using the expensive members-only club owned by a Tory donor during her stint as trade minister.
It doesn't seem to be held against anyone in the Conservative Party. We've seen lots of this around the test and trace thing at the beginning of the pandemic. We've seen Boris Johnson's flat. We've seen all sorts of stuff around this, and it doesn't seem to ever come back in anyone. So I don't think that's going to bother most Conservative MPs and most Conservative members.
It seems Liz Truss's major selling point is not her intellectual gravitas or political track record. In fact, the opposition points out she did not actually finalise a single new deal that the UK did not have with the EU as trade minister, but rather she's the anti-Sunak, a flip-flopping ideologue who is not an ethnic minority. For some Conservatives, that may just be enough. Amina Taylor, London.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
Our dear youth, who did not see nor feel the revolutionary era, should pay careful attention to these details. They must come to realize the issue behind this, U.S. animosity, and the main cause of it. If a people do not know what their main problems are or why, they will be misled. The concern for the US is that the revolution came and saved the country from morasses of different types, from morasses of dependence, backwardness, political and moral corruption, and global humiliation. We were suffering in these models. We had become dependent, humiliated, and backward. We were held behind. They held us back in scientific fields, in economic pursuits, technological advancements, on an international presence overall in everything. And in return for these setbacks, we had American and English mistresses and sirs as our overseers.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In those days, we used to export oil 4 times more than the present time. Moreover, the population was half the size of today's population. However, most areas of the country were deprived of public and governmental services. It is the duty of governments to provide such services. The country was wallowing in poverty, backwardness, and moral corruption. Iran was in a terrible state, including all the infrastructure of the country. In the area of roadways, water-related issues, electricity, gas, public schools, universities, and civil services, it was suffering from a state of backwardness and poverty in all social, political, and economic areas. They used to offer up the country's natural resources of wealth to foreigners. It was only the ruling government that benefited from this situation. If the people spoke against their policies, they would silence the people by deception or either by methods of harassment or intimidation. Nevertheless, the people were angry, and they could see the reality of the situation. The result was that they followed our magnanimous Imam's spiritual and divine call, which led to the revolution.
That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The Yemeni army has conducted several strikes on targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates in response to what it calls the Sheikhdom's complicity in the crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Sana'a's promise to continue the cross-border strikes until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war on the country is ended. But how is the UAE involved in the war? The country has been supporting the so-called Southern Transitional Council separatists in southern Yemen since at least 2018. Those are the mercenaries that took control of Yemen's resource-rich Socotra Island in 2020. This move was a departure from its coalition partner, Saudi Arabia, who is only interested in keeping the Yemeni army away from its border. But the UAE has shown interest in controlling the port of Aden as well. Its focus is to have control over the important waterway, the Bab al-Mandab, an important oil shipping route.
Clearly, that's exactly the intention and the reason that Israel and is involved is partly because that also means that they have at least the approval, the tacit approval of the United States as well. So they think that the UAE thinks that this is the way that they will be able to control this sea route. They're also building a base on the island of Perim, or Mayum, as it's called, just off the coast of Taiz in Yemen. And it's actually, this is also Yemeni territory. But it's right in the middle of the Bab al-Mandab. It's right in the middle of the routes of 20,000 ships that pass through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
The Yemeni army has in recent weeks been fighting and liberating land from the separatists in the provinces of Shabwa and Marib. The UAE is Saudi Arabia's main partner in the years-long war that Riyadh and its allies have been waging against Yemen to change the impoverished country's ruling structure. The military campaign has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire Yemen into the scene of what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The onslaught enjoys American military, logistical, and political support. The UAE is one of the most advanced air defense systems in the Persian Gulf region, but they haven't been quite successful at stopping the Yemeni army's missiles and drones. The Emiratis are now looking at South Korea, Israel, and France to supply them with additional weaponry and ammunition. In its largest arms export deal in history, South Korea agreed with the UAE to sell $3.5 billion worth of Cheongung II advanced medium-range surface-to-air missiles, along with accompanying radars. Abu Dhabi is also in talks with Tel Aviv to buy its missile system, dubbed the Iron Dome. The UAE is also eyeing purchasing either Israel's Barak 8 or Spider missile systems. The systems will be installed in addition to American-made THAAD air defense batteries. And all of this comes in the backdrop of the U.S. playing a more prominent role by sending an aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the UAE. In one recent attack by the Yemeni army, the U.S. shot down the Yemeni army missiles. What does all this signal? Will this mean that the Emirates is bent on pressing ahead with its aggression against Yemen, despite the obvious losses of its mercenaries on the ground in the war-ravaged country? And the U.S., along with Israel, have promised support.
The UAE had its own goals in Yemen, which were not the same as those of Saudi Arabia. But they could only happen. The UAE could only fulfill its goals in South Yemen if there was, the Saudi Arabia succeeded in its goals in northern Yemen. That is, Yemen had to be torn apart and split between Saudi Arabian influence and UAE influence.
At any rate, the Yemeni army is vowed to continue to pound targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the war is over. The Yemenis are warning that the Emirates and its trade-based economy won't be able to withstand the attacks. As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The Yemeni army has conducted several strikes on targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates in response to what it calls the Sheikhdom's complicity in the crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Sana'a has promised to continue the cross-border strikes until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war on the country is ended. But how is the UAE involved in the war? The country has been supporting the so-called Southern Transitional Council separatists in southern Yemen since at least 2018. Those are the mercenaries that took control of Yemen's resource-rich Socotra Island in 2020. This move was a departure from its coalition partner, Saudi Arabia, who is only interested in keeping the Yemeni army away from its border. But the UAE has shown interest in controlling the port of Aden as well. Its focus is to have control over the important waterway, the Bab al-Mandab, an important oil shipping route.
Clearly, that's exactly the intention and the reason that Israel and is involved is partly because that also means that they have at least the approval, the tacit approval of the United States as well. So they think that the UAE thinks that this is the way that they will be able to control this sea route. They're also building a base on the island of Perim, or Mayum, as it's called, just off the coast of Taiz in Yemen. And it's actually, this is also Yemeni territory. But it's right in the middle of the Bab al-Mandab. It's right middle of the routes of 20,000 ships that pass through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
The Yemeni army has in recent weeks been fighting and liberating land from the separatists in the provinces of Shabwa and Marib. The UAE, Saudi Arabia's main partner in the years-long war that Riyadh and its allies have been waging against Yemen to change the impoverished country's ruling structure. The military campaign has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire Yemen into the scene of what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The onslaught enjoys American military, logistical, and political support. The UAE is one of the most advanced air defense systems in the Persian Gulf region, but they haven't been quite successful at stopping the Yemeni army's missiles and drones. The Emiratis are now looking at South Korea, Israel, and France to supply them with additional weaponry and ammunition. In its largest arms export deal in history, South Korea agreed with the UAE to sell $3.5 billion worth of Cheongung II advanced medium-range surface-to-air missiles, along with accompanying radars. Abu Dhabi is also in talks with Tel Aviv to buy its missile system dubbed the Iron Dome. The UAE is also eyeing purchasing either Israel's Barak 8 or Spider missile systems. The systems will be installed in addition to American-made THAAD air defense batteries. And all of this comes in the backdrop of the U.S. playing a more prominent role by sending an aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the UAE. In one recent attack by the Yemeni army, the U.S. shot down the Yemeni army missiles. What does all this signal? Will this mean that the Emirates is bent on pressing ahead with its aggression against Yemen, despite the obvious losses of its mercenaries on the ground in the war-ravaged country? And the U.S., along with Israel, have promised support.
The UAE had its own goals in Yemen, which were not the same as those of Saudi Arabia. But they could only happen. The UAE could only fulfill its goals in South Yemen if there was, the Saudi Arabia succeeded in its goals in northern Yemen. That is, Yemen had to be torn apart and split between Saudi Arabian influence and UAE influence.
At any rate, the Yemeni army has vowed to continue to pound targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the war is over. The Yemenis are warning that the Emirates and its trade-based economy won't be able to withstand the attacks.
Meet the latest addition to Iran's diverse missile arsenal, Khaybar Shekan, a state-of-the-art missile unveiled earlier this week. It can strike its targets within a range of 1,450 kilometers with pinpoint precision. The ballistic missile is solid-fueled and therefore will be ready for launch much faster than liquid-fueled projectiles. It's even much faster and lighter than other Iranian solid-fueled models and can carry a powerful warhead. Ballistic missiles fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory. This makes them vulnerable to interception by air defense systems. But Iran's armed forces say Khaybar Shekan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for any advanced missile shield. Iran has been manufacturing various types of military equipment and weapons, including missiles, despite many rounds of Western sanctions against its arms industry and other sectors. Missiles are one of the cornerstones of Iran's defense doctrine. Iran has the Middle East's most diverse arsenal of projectiles, from very short-range rockets to advanced ballistic and cruise missiles with pinpoint capabilities. Iran has been working hard to enhance them, both in terms of range and precision.
Iran is merely trying to keep up in order to defend itself. I mean, I'm sure Iran and the Islamic Revolution would like to spend that money elsewhere. But as long as you're being threatened, it is necessary to develop yourself to a degree in order to be able to have that defense. Now, you can have all the greatness that you want, but if you're not capable of defending it, you'll eventually lose it.
The Iranian pursuit of more advanced projectiles has been relentless. It makes no secret of it, because Tehran says they are a must for effective defense in the world's most dangerous region. But how did Iran master the technology to produce advanced projectiles despite decades of sanctions and import bans imposed by the West? The Iranian missile program grew out of the war initiated by the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense. Iranians argue that they had no choice but building their own defense industry domestically and independently. The latest Iranian achievements are a far cry from the earliest models. Meanwhile, the West, especially the United States and its close allies, have described Iran's missile arsenal as a threat. They have tried to push Iran to abandon it, but Iranians seem to have learned to listen from the past and insist that their defensive missile power is a red line that will never be negotiated.
There has been a great deal of growing hostility towards Iran from the imperialist powers, and that in doing so, they have forced Iran to develop a greater and greater weapons with the capacity to defend themselves. They are under assault from imperialism, and this is a constant ongoing threat from the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia, who have formed the imperialist bloc inside of the Middle East.
When repeated Israeli threats against Iran are taken into account, the need for a robust defense program seems more urgent. Iran says its military might will enhance regional security. It also insists that it will never start a war, but if attacked, a crushing response will definitely follow.
Talks are resumed in Vienna to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. This is the eighth round of such talks in the Austrian capital. The U.S. has so far failed to remove its maximum pressure sanctions, which it imposed on Iran after the former pulled out of the JCPOA, and give guarantees that a future administration will not ditch the deal again. Now Iran's top security chief said that there is no coherence coming from the U.S., on the revival of the 2015 Iran deal. Ali Shamkhani has stressed that the U.S. administration cannot impose the cost of its internal disputes on Iran.
And I think that now what we are witnessing is a division internally in the United States in the political establishment, both Democrats and Republicans, regarding a resolution to the ongoing situation with Iran regarding whether to go back to the table and to rejoin the JCPOA. We know that Biden has made overtures and the State Department has said that they would grant some concessions in the forms of sanctions waivers. But like many Iranian commentators and politicians and diplomats have said, it doesn't go far enough.
Voices from the U.S. government show that there is no coherence in the country to make political decisions in the direction of advancements in the Vienna talks. The U.S. administration cannot pay for its internal disputes by violating Iran's legal rights. And voice from Iran and the P4 plus one group of countries, Britain, France, Russia, and China plus Germany, have been holding negotiations in the Austrian capital for 10 months in a bid to resurrect the JCPOA.
And I think that there's not much appetite for a deal with Iran at this point. I think the Trump administration did tremendous damage to the JCPOA by removing itself from it.
The new round of talks comes amid rising hawkish voices in the U.S. A group of 33 U.S. Republican senators, led by Senator Ted Cruz, wrote a letter to President Biden warning him that any deal with Iran on restoring the JCPOA requires Senate approval. The senators warned Biden that they will do everything in their power to block a possible deal if he moves forward without them. They also said that the implementation of any agreement will be severely, if not terminally, hampered if the Biden administration does not fulfill a range of obligations in relation to congressional oversight over any agreements. The Republican senators said that if there is a deal that does not have Senate approval, it would be subject to being reversed as soon as there is a new president.
We see that the United States has been belligerent and has continued to put what it calls a maximum pressure campaign on the Iranian people, on the Iranian state, on the legal and legitimate Iranian government. And we see it as a web of coordinated activities by which we also know that Israel and the Zionist lobby are also pushing very heavily in the United States, in Washington.
The former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally left the JCPOA in May 2018 and reimposed the anti-Iran sanctions that the deal had lifted. He also placed additional sanctions on Iran under other pretexts not related to the nuclear case as part of his maximum pressure campaign. The pressure campaign was led by the Israeli and Arab lobby groups in the U.S. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it is willing to compensate for Trump's mistake and rejoin the deal, but it has retained the sanctions as leverage.
So I think that the internal divisions in the United States politically will continue to give free rein to the national security state in the United States to continue to put maximum pressure on Iran. But we know very well that Iran is a sovereign country and it will defend itself.
Iranian officials have repeatedly stressed that the onus falls on the U.S. to remove all illegal sanctions against the Islamic Republic in a verifiable manner and guarantee that a new U.S. administration would not breach the JCPOA again.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being. A brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام كفاك من عقلك ما أوضح لك سبل غيك من رشدك.
Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, "It is enough if your wisdom distinguishes for you the ways of going astray from those of guidance."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. You know, dear friends, we see in the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam that he really described what life is for us. In his actions and in his behaviors and in his wise sayings, we find again that Imam Ali really showed us what life means, and he showed us how to live life in his truly universal and complete and perfect persona. In one of these instances, we find that Imam Ali says something very interesting about life and death and desires. Right? It seems like
in some way or the other, our life revolves around these three aspects: life, death, and desires, goals, aspirations, wishes. And it's interesting here, Imam Ali, in his universal persona, he says to us, if a human being knew when their life came to an end, they would not extend their desires. Now, one of the blessings that Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, has given to every single human being is the fact that we do not know when our life will end, right? This in itself is a blessing. Because if we knew exactly when our life would end, it would just disbalance everything in our life. What would we do? What would we not do? How would we act? How would we not act? And the most basic thing that we would lose if we knew exactly when we were going to die is peace of mind, right? We would be anxious, we would be stressed out, we would be frustrated, then we would become angry, and then we would probably start to commit sins and things like that. So the basic blessing of not knowing when we will die is the fact that we have peace of mind. But here there's another thing. Imam Ali points to another angle. He says that if we knew when our life was to end, then we would not extend our desires, or we would not extend our hopes, our aspirations, right? So for example, if we knew that we were going to die next week, then it's like, well, what's the point of praying? What's the point of going to school? What's the point of going to the masjid and praying in congregation? Or what's the point of going and earning money for my family? Or what's the point of giving charity? Or what's the point of saving money? Or what's the point of, you see? So all of a sudden, our desires, our goals, our aspirations, our wishes, our purpose, our mission, everything gets destroyed if we knew when our life came to an end. But there's a interesting flip side here. Do we not know that our life will surely end? Do we not know that we will be presented in front and in the presence of Allah on the Day of Judgment? Do we not know that all of our actions will be taken into account for? They will be measured. They will be weighed on the divine scale of truth and justice. So yes, we should be very careful in our actions. We should be smart in our actions. We should plan our actions. We should execute and implement our actions. We should refrain from sins, and we should do as much good as we possibly can, for surely our life will come to an end. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
كل صبح وكل اشراق ايام تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاق قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
وقتی شخصیت امیرالمومنین رو بشناسه در مقابل او خضوع میکند.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
We are on two sides. Either you love Ali ibn Abi Talib or you hate Ali ibn Abi Talib. That's if you know Ali ibn Abi Talib. And that is why we find a hadith from our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. أَنَّهُ قَالْ لِعَلِيٍ يَا عَلِي لَا يُحِبُّكَ إِلَّا مُؤْمِنٍ وَلَا يُبْغِذُكَ إِلَّا مُنَافِقٍ. He says, oh Ali, no. That those who love you, that is a sign of iman. Yeah? And for those who hate you, that is a sign of nifaq, hypocrisy in their hearts. Now, we need to look, before we describe what is it about Imam Ali alayhi salam that makes him loved and hated at the same time so much, we need to have an introduction to understand this whole idea or this concept of this jazibiyah, as it is known in Arabic, this attraction, power of attraction that human beings have, either to be liked or to be hated. Now, this law of attraction and repulsion is found throughout nature. Yes, it is not only that human beings have that. If you, for example, look at science, yeah, and if you look at magnets, for example, what is it that brings magnets together? This opposite attraction that they have, right? If you bring two positives, what will happen? They will reject, right? But if you bring a positive and a negative, they will combine. So here is an example that there is in nature a law of attraction. In the law of nature it is, opposites attract. Yeah, I don't know if that works in human beings, opposites attract. But in the law of nature it's there, that opposites attract. If you're a positive, a negative will attract you. And if you're a positive and positive, you will never be there together. When scientists do experiments, for example, you know, they say when a negatively charged rod is brought near an electroscope where there are negatively charged leaves, what would happen is if you bring this rod to these leaves, because they're both negatively charged, the leaves would fly away. But if the leaves were positively charged, the leaves would remain and be attracted to this electrical rod. Now when it comes to the human beings, they too have this power of attraction and repulsion.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.